Production. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear, Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you are already starting to see happen, then you had best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and he shall bring you to the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is March 7th, 2010, Sunday, and Bill Fink is joining us for the first installment of Goebbels on Bolshevism. This is part one. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello. Praise Yahweh.
Absolutely. Praise Yahweh. And just looking over this Goebbels article, he had a thorough understanding of Bolshevism, wouldn't you say?
Well, right. Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. That the Nazis were very educated as to Bolshevism and who its backers were. And,
mm-hmm.
and I'd like to have a lengthy discussion concerning that first.
Yes.
If you don't mind. And
I would just like to remind all the listeners that we just spent the last basically 3 months on Bolshevism in Russia. All those shows are archived and up. And for people that are just joining the series right now, they should probably listen to those 9 shows at some point to get an understanding of just what Bolshevism was about and why the Nazis rightly perceived it as a great threat, since it was happening basically just 2 countries away from their country. They understood exactly what was going on. All right.
Absolutely. That they understood everything that was going on. First, we've said in the past, and we've conceded, I should say, on many occasions, that the Germans helped finance the Bolshevik Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true. And I don't have all the details behind that, but I'm going to quote from None Dare Call It Conspiracy, which is by a gentleman, I believe his name is Gary Allen. This book is copyright 1971. It's on the New Ensign site. And I'm going to quote a paragraph from Chapter 4, Bankrolling the Bolsheviks. The Germans, on the face of it, had a plausible excuse for financing Lenin and Trotsky. The two Germans most responsible for the financing of Lenin were Max Warburg. Now we know he's a Jew and a banker.
He's not a German.
No, not at all. And a displaced Russian named Alexander Helpand. Now, that does not sound like a Russian name.
Well, wait a minute. That reminds me of the guy Parvis Helpand, who was in Wiebe's Germany and the Jewish Problem, one of the business shysters who was looting German companies. His name was Parvis Helpand, and
he was a Jew. No doubt. They could claim that they were serving their country's cause by helping and financing Lenin. Well, of course they could claim that, but that's not what they were doing. However, these two German, and he has this in quotes, patriots, neglected to mention to the Kaiser their plan to foment the communist revolution in Russia. The picture takes on another dimension when you consider that the brother of Max Warburg was Paul Warburg, prime mover in establishing the Federal Reserve System, and who, from his position on the Federal Reserve Board of Directors, played a key role in financing the American war effort. When news leaked out in American papers about Brother Max running the German finances, Paul resigned from his Federal Reserve post without a whimper.
Hmm.
Imagine that.
Oh,
both
Bill.
Sides of the war.
I just found the birth name. Oh, sorry. I just found the birth name of this Helpand. He was born Israel Lazarevich Gelfand.
You think he's a Jew? I'd say there's a good chance he's a Jew. That's funny. So it's really it really isn't, and so we have to correct the record. Well, it really is not Germany that helped finance Lenin. It's the Jewish German bankers that helped finance Lenin, just like the American Jewish bankers financed Lenin. And with that note, I'd like to quote from and I have several lengthy passages here. Adolf Hitler, Mein Kampf, page 125. And Hitler's talking about the connections between capitalism and communism. And he says, I began to study again. And thus it was that I first came to understand perfectly what was the substance and the purpose of the life work of the Jew Karl Marx. His capital, referring to Das Kapital, became intelligible to me now for the first time, and in the light of it, I now exactly understood the fight of the Social Democrats against national economics, a fight which was to prepare the ground for the hegemony of a real international and stock exchange capital. You see, Adolf Hitler fully identified the international capitalists and as the parties behind global Marxism and Bolshevism. And he knew that they were breaking down the Christian nations in order to control them. And capitalism is the slow route to that control. And capitalism has been followed by socialism everywhere. And that's where we are now. And Bolshevism is the fast route to that control. And there's several other lengthy passages I have here from Hitler which will elucidate the fact that he knew that both the Jews that the Jews were behind both capitalism and communism, and they were working both of them to their end so that they can control the world. First, I'll quote from Adolf Hitler, Mein Kampf, page 158. Hitler speaking about internationalism and globalism and multiculturalism and internationalism. They're all part of the same ball of wax. Let me say that when Christians want to think about these things, what they should realize is that Yahweh established borders for the Adamic race. We see it in Genesis chapter 10. We see it in Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 8. We see it in Acts chapter 17, verse 26. But the Jews have no borders. Wherever you see a push for internationalism, you'll know that the race of Cain is behind it, because they're the eternal wanderers, are they not?
Mm-hmm. Well, they really have no homeland. In fact, Palestine's not even their homeland. It's just their hole in the wall, a safe house, a base of operations.
Well, yes, it is a base of operations and a safe house. That's exactly what it is. Adolf Hitler, Mein Kampf, page 158. The fact that the international profiteers who gathered at Versailles further to exploit and plunder the nations directed their enmity especially against the old German army proved once again that it deserved to be regarded as the institution which protected the liberties of our people against the forces of international stock exchange. If the army had not been there to sound the alarm and stand on guard, the purposes of the Versailles representatives would have been carried out much sooner. There is only one word to express what the German people owe to this army. Everything. In other words, he's saying that Versailles probably would have been a lot worse if it weren't for the German army. Mm-hmm. Adolf Hitler, Mein Kampf, pages 180 to 1. And he's saying that it's the international capitalists that made Versailles as bad as it was for the German people. Adolf Hitler, Mein Kampf, pages 180 to 181. Hitler's talking about the Jews behind both capitalism and communism. While our bourgeois middle class paid no attention at all to this momentous problem and indifferently allowed the events to take their course, the Jew seized upon the manifold possibilities which the situation offered for him for the future. While on the one hand, he organized capitalistic methods of exploitation to their ultimate degree of efficiency, he curried favor with the victims of his policy and his power, and in a short while, he became the leader of their struggle against himself. Against himself, he is here only a figurative way of speaking. For this great master of lies knows how to appear in the guise of the innocent and throw the guilt on others. Since he had the impudence to take a personal lead among the masses, they never for a moment suspected that they were falling prey to one of the most infamous deceits ever practiced. And yet that is what it actually was.
So,
in other words, the Jew is oppressing the world with capitalism, and the Jew comes up with a solution. And all they're really doing is herding the sheep down the same path to hell, just from two different directions. That's
basically
Hitler's point.
Claims to champion the working class, but the Jew is the main oppressor of the working class.
Well, that's what he's saying. He's saying he riles the masses against himself, and it's all a game. It's all a game. It's good cop, bad cop. It's an old game. To work the both ends to the same cause. On the same page, yeah, you know, and this is an aside, on the same page, Hitler said, what we have to fight for is the necessary security for the existence and increase of our race and people, the subsistence of its children and the maintenance of its racial stock unmixed, the freedom and independence of the fatherland, so that our people may be enabled to fulfill the mission assigned to it by the Creator. And my comment would be that if you think Hitler was a Jew, you are an idiot. Adolf Hitler, Mein Kampf, pages 180 to 181. Hitler on a Jewish method of destroying Christendom. That's my summary. The black-haired Jewish youth lies in wait for hours on end, satanically glaring at and spying on the unsuspicious girl whom he plans to seduce. That sounds like Genesis chapter 3, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Adulterating her blood and removing her from the bosom of her own people. The Jew uses every possible means to undermine the racial foundations of a subjugated people. In his systematic efforts to ruin girls and women, he strives to break down the last barriers of discrimination between him and other peoples. The Jews were responsible for bringing Negroes into the Rhineland, with the ultimate idea of bastardizing the white race, which they hate, and thus lowering its cultural and political level so that the Jew might dominate. For as long as the people remain racially pure and are conscious of the treasure of their blood, they can never be overcome by the Jew. Never in this world can the Jew become master of any people except a bastardized people. That is why the Jew systematically endeavors to lower the racial quality of a people by permanently adulterating the blood of the individuals who make that people up. Now, what have we seen in the last 50 or 60 years in America?
What
have
he's written
not
here,
seen that?
We've seen this happen, and no Jew could write these words.
No Jew could possibly write these words, and I don't want to put Adolf Hitler on the same level as Isaiah, but he sure as hell knew what was going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was one of a number of watchmen standing on the wall raising the alarm, and no one listened.
There is no doubt. There is absolutely no doubt. That is a perfect comparison.
Well, the German people listened, but they ended up suffering for it. They paid the ultimate price for listening. Because they rose up against evil, they took a stand against evil, whereas in America, we capitulated and hopped in the bed with the evil.
Right. Let me proceed. In the field, and that's exactly what happened. In the field of politics, he now begins to replace the idea of a democracy by introducing the dictatorship of the proletariat. Well, here they do it under a slightly different method. They do it under the guise of homeland security. In the masses organized under the Marxist banners, he has found a weapon which makes it possible for him to discard democracy. And we see they're doing that here today in a different way. So as to subjugate and rule in a dictatorial fashion by the aid of brute force. Can you say Waco? He is systematically working in two ways to bring about this revolution. These ways are the economic and the political, respectively. Aided by international influences, he forms a ring of enemies around those nations which has proved themselves to be too sturdy for him in withstanding attacks from within. Here, Hitler's describing the fate of his own nation, and he don't even know it yet. He would like to force them into war, and then, if it should be necessary to his plans, he will unfurl the banners of revolt even while the troops are actually fighting at the front.
That's
exactly what happened to Hitler's Germany 15 years after he wrote Mein Kampf, 20 years after he wrote Mein Kampf.
And it's what happened to America during the Vietnam War, and it's what the Jews tried to do in South Africa.
Absolutely. And Germany stood up to the international Jew, and the Jews destroyed it. And Hitler knew it. He knew it was going to happen. He wrote about it. There it is. Adolf Hitler, Mein Kampf, page 115. Hitler on the loss of the First World War by Germany. Quote, for want of munitions, the front would be broken through within a few weeks. The offensive would be effectively stopped and the Entente saved. He's talking about Germany on the verge of winning World War One. Then international finance would assume control over Germany and the internal objective of the Marxist national betrayal would be achieved. That objective was the destruction of the national economic system and the establishment of international capitalistic domination in its stead. And that's for want of munitions. And this goal has really been reached thanks to the stupid credulity of the one side and the unspeakable treachery of the other. And he says that because of the munition strikes in the factories when he thought Germany should have been on the verge of winning the war.
There was a Jewish documentary on the History Channel earlier saying that Germany had militarily won the war, but they had lost on the home front due to bad propaganda and a failure to meet the demands of the workers, and that workers rose up. Well, what they really don't say, that's not the truth.
They don't say who led those workers' revolts.
Mm-hmm. That's maybe about a third of the truth.
The workers. Right. It's absolutely only a third of the truth.
And they named a few Socialist Party members, but they didn't point out that they were Jewish. And that's the common thread in all of this, isn't it? That the Jews basically, and as far as Germany was concerned, the Jews snatched defeat from the jaws of victory.
Absolutely. Now let's see who orchestrated World War One. Adolf Hitler, Mein Kampf, page 115. Hitler on the cause of the First World War against Germany, the disadvantages of the German alliance with Austria, and the peril it created for Germany. Quote, in the first place, Austria had too many enemies who were eagerly looking forward to obtain the heritage of that decrepit state, so that these people gradually developed a certain animosity against Germany because Germany was an obstacle to their desires inasmuch as it kept the dual monarchy from falling to pieces. A consummation that was hoped for and yearned for on all sides. The conviction developed that Vienna could be reached only by passing through Berlin. In the second place, by adopting this policy, Germany lost its best and most promising chances of other alliances. In place of these possibilities, one now observed a growing tension in the relations with Russia and even with Italy, and this in spite of the fact that the general attitude in Rome was just as favorable to Germany as it was hostile to Austria, a hostility which lay dormant in the individual Italian and broke out violently on occasion. In the third place, the alliance constituted a permanent danger to German security, for any great power that was hostile to Bismarck's empire could mobilize a whole lot of other states in a war against Germany by promising them tempting spoils at the expense of the Austrian ally. It was possible to arouse the whole of Eastern Europe against Austria, especially Russia, and Italy also. The world coalition, which had developed under the leadership of King Edward, could never have become a reality if Germany's ally, Austria, had not offered such an alluring prospect of booty. It was this fact alone which made it possible to combine so many heterogeneous states with divergent interests into one common phalanx of attack. Every member could hope to enrich himself at the expense of Austria if he joined in a general attack against Germany. The fact that Turkey was also a tacit party to the unfortunate alliance with Austria augmented Germany's peril to an extraordinary degree. Jewish international finance needed this bait of the Austrian heritage in order to carry out its plans of ruining Germany. But Germany had not yet surrendered to the general control which the international captains of finance and trade exercised over the other states. He knew exactly what World War One was about. Thus, it was possible to consolidate that coalition and make it strong enough and brave enough through the sheer weight of numbers to join in bodily conflict with the Horn Siegfried, and a metaphor for Germany. Hitler knew exactly why the Jews had planned World War One, and that was to gain financial domination over all the states of Europe.
Yes.
The House of Rothschild. He knew exactly what was going on.
And the fact is that the alliance with Austria was counterintuitive, since Germany was obtaining alliances to secure the existence of the German people, while the decadent Habsburg monarchy existed to the detriment of the German people. They were trying to Slavify their entire realm.
Right.
And they were basically putting the...
Hitler explains that elsewhere, but that's basically what he's saying here, is that the, you know, the alliance with the Habsburgs is Germany's biggest
pointless problem. It was an albatross around Germany's neck.
Yes, and Hitler understood that, and that's what he just explained in many more words.
It would have made more sense to ally with Russia against Austria, or Britain against Russia, or even, for that matter, Italy against Austria. For, you know, Austria was basically a worthless ally. They dragged Germany into a war, and they didn't even fight. They didn't even measure up. They didn't do their part. And at this point, could we safely say that the Habsburg monarchy, we might as well just call it the Jewish monarchy?
Well, it seems to me they did everything the Jews wanted so that the Jews could destroy them, because that's what Satan does, right?
Mm-hmm.
He leads you to your destruction. Adolf Hitler, pages 289 to 290 of Mein Kampf, Hitler on the Marxist peril of post-war Germany and the revolution of December 1918. The revolution was really popular, only with a small section of the German people, and so it was in Russia, right? Namely, that class and their accomplices who had selected the rucksack as the hallmark of all honorable citizens in this new state. They did not like the revolution for its own sake, though many people still erroneously believe the contrary, but for the consequences which followed in its train. But it was very difficult to establish any abiding authority on the popular support given to these Marxist freebooters. And yet the young republic stood in need of authority at any cost, unless it was ready to agree to be overthrown after a short period of chaos by an elementary force assembled from those last elements that still remained among the best extreme of the population. The real organizer of the revolution and the actual wire puller behind it, the international Jew, had sized up the situation correctly. The German people were not yet ripe to be drawn into the blood swamp of Bolshevism as the Russian people had been drawn. And that was because there was a closer racial union between the intellectual classes in Germany and the manual workers. In other words, they were all German. And also because broad social strata were permeated with cultured people, such as was the case also in the other states of Western Europe. But this state of affairs was completely lacking in Russia. In that country, the intellectual classes were mostly not of Russian nationality. In fact, a number of them were Germans and a number of them were Jews, right? Or at least they did not have the racial characteristics of the Slav. The thin upper layers of intellectuals, which then existed in Russia, might be abolished at any time, because there was no intermediate stratum connecting it organically with the great mass of the people. There, the mental and moral level of the great mass of the people was frightfully low. So what Hitler's saying is that in Germany is much more racially homogenous, and the Jew could not bring it to the point of Bolshevik revolt.
They couldn't incite one group against another group.
Right. It was a lot more difficult, where it was easier to do that in Russia. And he says very clearly that it's the international capitalists who did it in Russia. The international Jew.
Well, I'd like to point out, too, page 45, Mein Kampf. And so I began to gather information about the authors of this teaching, referring to Marxism, with a view to studying the principles of the movement. The fact that I attained my object sooner than I could have anticipated was due to the deeper insight into the Jewish question, which I then gained, my knowledge of this question being hitherto rather superficial. This newly acquired knowledge alone enabled me to make a practical comparison between the real content and the theoretical pretentiousness of the teaching laid down by the apostolic founders of social democracy. Because I now understood the language of the Jew, I realized that the Jew uses language for the purpose of dissimulating his thought, or at least veiling it, so that his real aim cannot be discovered by what he says, but rather by reading between the lines. This knowledge was the occasion of the greatest inner revolution that I had yet experienced. From being a soft-hearted cosmopolitan, I became an out-and-out anti-Semite. And I originally considered that myself. I asked myself, did Marx found this doctrine intending to liberate the workers and it simply backfired and caused all sorts of problems in a communist dictatorship? Or did Marx found this doctrine intending from day one to wreck Europe and undermine the moral foundations and the moral fabric of European civilization? And of course, I concluded the latter. after several months of study.
Well, there's no doubt in my mind that Marxism and communism are the political expression of the Talmud.
Mm-hmm.
I have no doubt. The Talmud, the attitude of the Talmud is that the quote-unquote Gentile should have nothing and only be a slave to the Jew.
Or be killed. Even the best of the Gentiles should be exterminated.
And the Jew should have everything. And right, exterminate the Gentiles who are possibly a threat to the Jew.
So communism is just a way to make Jewish supremacism palatable to the non-Jewish masses.
And that's exactly what they've done. And half of our race has marched itself to hell. And
it seems
the Jew
under
has to lift a finger.
Every Jew becomes a commissar and every goyim becomes a serf.
Right. And all right, this I really like this quote. Mein Kampf, page 139. To me, it sums it all up. The function of the so-called liberal press was to dig the grave for the German people and the Reich. No mention need be made of the lying Marxist press. To them, the spreading of falsehood is as much a vital necessity as the mouse is to the cat. Their sole task is to break the national backbone of the people, thus preparing the nation to become the slaves of international finance and its masters, the Jews. Mein Kampf, page 139. And I've only cited half the quotes that reveal that Adolf Hitler was aware that the Jew is behind capitalism, the Jew is behind Marxism and Bolshevism, and that they were working together to destroy Christianity, to destroy the Aryan nations. And the best way to find all these quotes is to go to the Mein Kampf site at Christogenia and search for the word international. That's how I did it this afternoon. And they all popped right up.
Didn't Hitler know without a doubt that parliamentarian democracy would naturally result in Marxism-Leninism?
I'm sorry, run that by me again.
Hitler knew that parliamentarian democracy would naturally result in Marxism-Leninism.
Well, right, because the people are swayed by the press, and who runs that?
Absolutely.
Because they control capital, they have to control democracy. It's the two ideas go hand in hand.
That Mein Kampf, page 53, democracy is practiced in Western Europe today is the forerunner of Marxism. In fact, the latter would not be conceivable without the former. Democracy is the breeding ground in which the bacilli of the Marxist world pest can grow and spread. By the introduction of parliamentarianism, democracy produced an abortion of filth and fire, the creative fire of which, however, seems to have died out.
There is no doubt.
So if he looked at Europe today, he would say that the Europe of today is the natural result of decades of 1920s-era parliamentarianism.
Marx won, not only in Europe, but even here,
mm-hmm.
even here in America and in Canada. We're all Marxist states.
And there's no way patriots can compete politically since they've shut us out of the political establishment. We've been shut out of the political system. We don't have access to the masses. We cannot effectively spread our propaganda. We have no media of our own. We have no way to lobby.
We have no political solution. That's the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
And there are very strong religious reasons for that, and that's the way it is. That's why I wrote that paper. That's I'm not beating my chest, but that's the point where we're at. There is no political solution.
You know, we needed a Hitler 30 or 40 years ago, and we never had one.
Well, absolutely. In America, in Britain, and in France, we just and in Canada. Well, we just sold ourselves out to the Jew. Well, we just laid down prostrate before the Jew.
What few people came around or came along to try and warn us, such as George Lincoln Rockwell, they were ridiculed and then ultimately assassinated.
Absolutely. The very few that did stand up to them. But even Rockwell was no Hitler.
Mm-hmm. But even still, I mean, Wallace received, what, 11 or 12% of the vote, but I mean, that's pathetic. In the 1960s, he should have received 80 or 90% of the vote. What was white America thinking?
Well, you know, the Jews have controlled the press since the 1890s, basically.
Mm-hmm.
It's nothing new.
So they just think what the Jews tell them to think.
Yes, they do. 90% of Americans do. They get all their news, everything they think they know, after they got out of school, from a Jewish-operated media outlet. And that's nearly, and whether you fancy yourself a conservative or a liberal, you're basically towing the line of the Jewish-controlled Wall Street Journal or the Jewish-controlled New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
Jewish-controlled Fox News or Jewish-controlled CNN.
What's the difference? You're either a Jew-approved neocon or a Jew-approved socialist.
Well, basically. And the ends of both philosophies are the same. The only refuge for the white man is Christianity,
mm-hmm.
is true Christianity. That's the only thing the Jew hates. The white man could be a pagan and a Jew will love him.
Well,
the white man
nowhere.
Could be an Episcopalian and the Jew will love him.
That's because the Jew
knows until he gets
nowhere.
Every last dime out of him and then he'll just throw him away. Well, do you want to proceed with Bolshevism in Theory and Practice?
All right. Bolshevism in Theory and Practice by Dr. Joseph Goebbels. Speech delivered in Nuremberg, September 10, 1936, at the 8th National Socialist Party Congress. Lenin, the founder of the Bolshevik Revolution, stated frankly that falsehoods are not only justified but have proved to be the most effective tools in the Bolshevik struggle. Goebbels, September 1936. Printed and published by M. Mueller and Sohn, KG Berlin. My Führer, Your Excellencies, my honorable guests, fellow members of the National Socialist Party, the fact that the phenomenon of Bolshevism, as represented by the theory of Marx and put into practice by the Russian Soviet state, is still engaging the attention of political circles in Western Europe as a theoretical phenomenon and a political reality which civilized people ought to take into account intellectually as well as politically, shows that there is a fatal lack of insight into the nature and essential structure of international Bolshevism. What is called Bolshevism has nothing whatsoever to do with what we understand by ideas and an outlook on life, Weltanschauung, in general. It is nothing but a pathological and criminal kind of madness devised by Jews, as can well be proved, and led by Jews who aim at destroying the civilized nations of Europe and at founding a Jewish international world regime that would subject all nations to their power. And don't we pretty much have that today under the auspices of the United Nations?
Absolutely. That's what it's all about. It's another branch office of the House of Rothschild.
And they got that after World War II, so it seems after destroying the National Socialist regime in Germany, the Jews got everything they wanted in the world.
And giving away half of Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Bolshevism could have had its origin only in the Jewish brain, and the sterile asphalt of the metropolis alone made it possible for this thing to grow and spread. It could only be accepted by a species of mankind that had been morally and economically shattered by the war and the economic crisis which followed. On such people, it was let loose and was acceptable to them because its criminal and crazy doctrine appealed to them. Though superfluous, it may here once again be emphasized that we National Socialists, in fighting this world peril as mercilessly as we did from the very first hour of our political activity up to the present, have not defended anti-socialist or even pro-capitalist interests. Our struggle against Bolshevism is no fight against but in favor of socialism. Our attitude grew out of a deep conviction that a true and genuine socialism can only be realized if its lowest and most ill-born offspring, Jewish Bolshevism, would have been done away with. The fight against Bolshevism can only be carried through to a successful issue by a people that has found a new structure for its folk life, which is adequate to the dynamic values and standards of the 20th century, a socialist structure in the national form. The bourgeois middle classes of all nations have proved to be important in dealing with Bolshevism and are impotent in dealing with Bolshevism and are unfitted for the fight against it. They have not yet even gained a clear insight into the principles which inspire and direct Bolshevism. They lack the spiritual quality, the principled conscience, political faith, and moral strength of character that alone would enable them to face it. Haven't we seen this in the United States, where basically the so-called greatest generation, came back from World War II, went to college on the GI Bill, moved to the suburbs, and just sat on their fat butts while their kids were brainwashed into Marxists.
That's exactly what happened. That's precisely what happened. And today they're in denial. Today they're all AARP members in denial. And all they care about is their Social Security check.
Or who's going to get them their prescription medicine.
And they'll do anything.
And they don't
the government
really care
is always right. And they are the greatest generation. They're the greatest generation of traitors.
They don't care that 30 or 40 different guys had their daughter when she went to college, and that now their grandkids are, they have bolts through their noses, and they're listening to rap music and drinking beer in the middle of high school and doing God knows what when they go to house parties or whatever they're doing these days.
Well, that was in my mind, that was the punishment of a race that volunteered to follow the Jew and destroy half of its own kindred. And that's their punishment. Their punishment are the children. We are their punishment.
Right. But not only do they lack the necessary insight, they even attempt to compromise with Bolshevism whenever an opportunity arises so as to, quote, prevent an even greater evil. But every part which the bourgeois world contracts with radical Bolshevism will finally lead to a victory of Bolshevism over the bourgeois world because of the natural law according to which the stronger will always prevail over the weaker. And hasn't this basically happened that we made an agreement with the Soviets and then they ended up subverting us in the end?
Well, we have, yes. The Soviets, and I don't believe that they were the only subverters of the West, but that was a huge safe house for the Jews. And a lot of Jewish perverts came out of the Soviet Union to start religions here. And they're just the ones we see. Who knows how many we don't see. And I'm talking about Zechariah Sitchin, Emanuel Velikovsky, Ben Klassen. They all came from the Soviet Union at a time when only Jews were allowed to leave the Soviet Union.
Absolutely. And Ben Klassen had to be a Jew because he was basically an anti-Christian freak, and he committed suicide by overdosing on pills.
And it's all, they're just part of a 50 million front war against our culture.
Well, what Yuri Bezmenov, KGB defector, said, he said that they always try and ridicule religion, and one of the ways they do that is they start cults to discredit genuine religion, and I think Klassen was part of that.
And he was absolutely part of that. There is no doubt. And that it's not only Klassen, but it's thousands of Klassens.
Mm-hmm.
All of these little strange little sects that popped up through the 60s and 70s.
Jim Jones was a big one.
There you go, and he was a Marxist. He was an avowed Marxist.
Mm-hmm. Some people may not know it, but he was actually trying to move his entire congregation, his multiracial congregation, to North Korea. He said that North Korea was the last free country in the world. He was mad at the Soviet Union because they turned him down and they were turning their back on Stalin and Mao. So he said it had to be North Korea or nowhere, and North Korea didn't want him. So that was when he decided it was time to put the cyanide in the punch and start passing out glasses. All right. Bolshevism has at least one very definite advantage over all other groups that hold political power, accepting not only justified, but have proved to be most effective. Wait, is that the right page? Oh, darn, that's not the right.
Skip the line.
Not the right page.
Bolshevism has at least one very definite advantage over all other groups that hold political power, excepting those who face it with absolute and downright opposition. It mobilizes recklessly the lower grades of mankind, which exist among the dregs of every nation, and are opposed to the state and the ideas which sustain it. It is the organization of the lowest instincts of a people, aiming at the destruction of all productive and valuable elements in a race. That's exactly what we saw in the Russian number one report, isn't it? It usually seizes upon a group that holds political power, which is based upon a brutish minority, and which is determined to reach its final political aim with unscrupulous and criminal tactics. But the Bolshevik readiness for tactical compromises must not be taken as a willingness to compromise, as far as their principles are concerned. At bottom, Bolshevism knows no compromise. If it makes a compromise, that is only done for one reason, i.e., to use it as a means to seize unlimited power. It does not hesitate to cut the throats of those who have helped it to gain power after they have gained it. Not a very alluring prospect for those bourgeois politicians of some of the Western European states who still believe that the sting may be taken from Bolshevism by the tamer Front Populaire, which I guess was a socialist front.
And didn't, for those that listened to the Bolshevism in Russia series, the Dutch ambassador said that any claims that they made about fighting foreign powers in exchange for aid from the Allies for coming to power in Russia were false and erroneous, and that they would make any claim that they had to in order to come to power.
Right. He said we can't finance any socialist group. None of them. That's exactly what he warned about. Bolshevism is the dictatorship of the inferior. It seizes power by means of falsehoods. It maintains power by means of force. And that's exactly what happened in Russia. To be able to combat it, one must know it thoroughly, and one must have penetrated into its deepest secrets. The more worthy forces of a nation have to be mobilized to exterminate it, since it is the organization of everything that may be called the anti-racial forces of the people. That's exactly what we see here, isn't it? With the ARA and the ADL and all those groups.
They're all basically
pushing us.
Militant Jewish organizations that are enforcing the will of the Jewish bankers.
Which wants to push us into Talmudism, which is what communism is. That's exactly right. By leading us, they become our masters.
I see them in the streets ranting about capital and finance, yet they don't realize that they were mobilized at the behest of finance and capital.
Right. They have no clue themselves. And that's in the protocols that they would use the scum of their own race to defeat us, and that's what they do. Those bankers won't have anything to do with those Jewish kids in the ARA. They're scum. But they'll use them against the white man and his culture.
And in Europe, they've even used some of them to assassinate Holocaust deniers and various activists. So they're basically useful for that. They're disposable. They're useful idiots. But I wonder, would Rothschild want to invite one of them over and say, hey, marry my daughter?
No, that's not going to happen. He'd rather marry his daughter to an Englishman and pollute the Englishman's blood. That's much better use of a daughter. They don't care about their own. There is one sphere in particular wherein Bolshevism has shown its mastery, i.e. that of negative propaganda. It gains a foothold among the nations by means of lies and hypocrisy. Satan's old tricks over and over again. It aims at presenting a garbled picture of the nature and inner form of this political madness. Lenin, the father of the Bolshevist Revolution, stated frankly that falsehoods are not only justified, but have proved to be the most effective tools in the Bolshevist struggle. Schopenhauer has said that the Jews are the masters of lies, and therefore, and I think Christ said it before Schopenhauer, right? And therefore, it is no surprising fact that Bolshevism and Jewry here meet in close kinship. Jewish Bolshevism is a past master in the manipulation of lies. Decent and truthful people are so stunned by this method that they are incapable of offering inner resistance. That is just what the Jewish Bolshevists have been aiming at. They speculate on the incapacity of the average truthful person to imagine that it is even possible to lie with such bold and brazen-faced nonchalance as they lie. And let me say that the biggest failure of our race is not to heed the advice of Johnny Apostle, who basically said that when a Jew moves his lips, he's lying.
Well,
I mean, who is a liar but he who denies that Yahshua is the end? It is not the Christ.
So why should we believe anything the Jew has to say when he starts singing about 6 million or Oy vey, oppressed workers rise up? He denies that Jesus is Messiah, so they're all Antichrist demons.
Right. And they're Antichrist, and we're to have nothing to do with them. But we forgot those lessons. The church wouldn't, the Catholic Church wouldn't let people read the Bible, and basically by the time they started to read it, the Jew was already running the biblical seminaries. So
most white people can't conceive that such a race of deceitful, rotten liars could even exist, but we're told that they're of their father Satan, who's the father of lies, and when he lies, he speaks of his own, for he's the father of all lies.
There's no doubt that the Bible teaches us not to have anything to do with the Jew.
Mm-hmm.
And,
so
and there's no doubt that our mainstream religions taught us, except for a few of the reformers, and they were Martin Luther, and there may have been a few others, but I can't name them. And they taught us exactly the opposite. All of our mainstream religions have taught us exactly the opposite that the Bible teaches. And I don't know if it's never not been like that, except for roughly 1,000 years in between the time of Justinian, or really the time of Theodosius, and the time of the De Medicis, when the Jew was absolutely excoriated from society. And this is biblical prophecy happening. It could not be avoided. And we should be blessed that we can see it. But we certainly couldn't do anything about it because it's written in the book. I'm going to continue. It is possible to lie like that. Bolshevism has shown it to be possible, and it has been successful in surprising and winning over many unsuspicious people. In accordance with the very nature of Bolshevism, its propaganda is international and aggressive. It aims at the radicalization of all the nations of the world to bring about anarchy and Bolshevism. It has got tremendous supplies of funds at its disposal, which are unlimited because the Bolshevik dictators unscrupulously starve the entire Russian people in order to spend money for this purpose. This kind of propaganda is particularly insidious for outside countries because it is supported by the communist parties of those countries, i.e. by the respective foreign sections of the Comintern. The communist parties outside of Russia are nothing but foreign legions of the Comintern. With their support, Bolshevism organizes and lays out ingenious plans of international sedition, which are very difficult to attack because they have their roots in the political and national life of the respective nations. It must be estimated as the most threatening peril to a state to allow the existence of a domestic party which takes its orders from the authorities of a foreign country. Experience shows that countries where a strong communist party exists are more or less subject to the dictates of Stalin with regard to their home, social, economic, military, and foreign policy. When concluding a treaty, one of the Western European great powers had, for example, to make the request first that the communist party that exists on its soil should be ordered from Moscow to stop undermining the army and vetoing the credits for military purposes. The communist sections in the various countries are ordered to prepare and to carry through the Bolshevist revolution. They are supplied with abundant funds unequaled anywhere else to carry on this ingenious propaganda for which Moscow has laid out the model.
Yes. Shouldn't this raise some eyebrows amongst people in the world that the communists who rant against capital and finance are the most well-funded political parties in the world?
Well, that never, and I don't think that ever came into people's thoughts because they so obscured and concealed their sources of funding.
Mm-hmm. It seems rather convenient, though, doesn't it, that for people that rant against business incessantly, they have more money than even the parties the business leaders try and organize.
This propaganda has only one object and purpose. It aims at deceiving the other nations as to the true nature of Bolshevism, and either to prevent the leaking out of facts from Soviet Russia or to falsify them so that they lose their value as reliable news. And let me say that Jews running most of the Western media, that was probably pretty easy to do. I mean, until after World War II, The only, as far as I've read, the only news agency that sent news to North America from Europe was Reuters. Okay. The reason for such a policy is that the Soviet Union cannot allow the truth about its domestic conditions to be known, particularly not in Western Europe, with its more civilized and intelligent citizens. The poison of the Bolshevist theory may be alluring and enticing, but Bolshevism in practice is terrible and horror-striking. Its way is marked by mountains of skeletons. An ocean of blood and tears floods that unhappy tract. Human life has lost all value. Terrorism, murder, bestiality, these are the traits that characterize every Bolshevist revolution, whether it be successful, as in Russia, or fail and be suppressed, as in Hungary, Bavaria, the Ruhr district, and Berlin, or still fighting for power, as is the case in Spain today. And a lot of that news in Spain did hit the West, but the it seems not to have taken a role, a public role in the communist scares here. I don't think it did. I don't know. You want to proceed? Have you found your place?
All right. What page do we leave off on?
I think I'll keep reading until you find me. When Bolshevism has gained control, it stops worrying about contradictions between theory and practice. Carbines and machine guns then hold the field. But anywhere else outside of its home territory, it uses its ingeniously devised propaganda machinery to deceive the world as to its own true nature. Bourgeois people in Europe have not the slightest knowledge of how these facts are proceeding. They try to avoid a decision by mouthing the same phrase over and over again, namely that nobody is allowed to interfere in the domestic affairs of a foreign country.
Well, that worked so well for Rhodesia and South Africa, didn't it?
Yes, it did. But what is the reality now in Russia? But it didn't work for Germany. How come? Well, that's the hypocrisy of modern liberalism. It's incredible. And the I'm going to call them dumb goyim because that's what they are, don't realize the hypocrisy of their Jewish masters. What is the reality now in Russia? What is fought for and against in Spain, and what is fatally preparing its way in other European states, that is a matter of concern for the whole world. It is no longer a problem that can be dealt with by those who theorize about the various outlooks on life. It is rather a matter of grave concern for statesmen all over the world.
And this is what the Dutch ambassador said 20 years previous.
Yes, it is. It's exactly what the Dutch ambassador said.
He said that if it wasn't stopped, it would spread over all of Europe and over all of the world because it was organized and worked by Jews who have no nationality. And here we are 20 years later. Bolshevism is consolidated in all of Russia, taken over basically every country neighboring Russia, and now it's threatening to spread to Spain. It would have spread in Germany had it not been for the Freikorps and the rise of the National Socialists, and it's threatened all of Eastern Europe, and most Western European nations now have vibrant, strong communist parties in their parliaments, don't they?
Most Western European nations are communist.
Mm-hmm.
Look at Sweden, has an 80-90% top tax rate. Tell me that the average American who works for a living pays half his money in taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Half of your money in taxes, is that not a communist nation?
And the other half of your money is worth next to nothing because it's been hyperinflated.
How could you pay 50% in direct and in hidden taxes? The average American family making $60,000-$70,000 a year, and usually that's with two people working, is paying half its pay and half of its money in taxes. Between the state taxes, the use taxes, the income taxes, only a small part of it.
All right. Would you like me to take over from here?
Sure.
They will have to tackle this problem unless they wish to become responsible for the future development, which because of their negligence will push Europe into the most severe crisis and eventually into ruin. The problem of Bolshevism as it faces Europe today is a question of to be or not to be. Here and now, the souls of men are ranged on the one side or the other. A definite side will have to be taken either against or in favor of Bolshevism, and all consequences resulting therefrom will have to be accepted. Another problem must be settled. The problem of the role which Jewry plays in relation to Bolshevism. Only in Germany can it be openly discussed, since it would be dangerous in any other country. as was also the case in Germany not so many years ago, even to mention the Jewry by name. There can be no doubt that Jews are the founders of Bolshevism, and that it is they who represent it. The old leading class in Russia has been so completely eliminated that no other leadership group was left behind but the Jews. Every conflict within Bolshevism is therefore more or less a family conflict among Jews. The recent executions in Moscow, for example, the shootings of Jews by Jews, can only be understood on motives of thirst for power and determination to destroy all opponents. The belief that Jews are always at perfect harmony with one another is a widespread error. They live in unity only when they form a minority that is kept in control and menaced by a large national majority. In present-day Russia, this is not the case anymore. If Jews have attained power, as they exclusively have done in Russia, the old Jewish rivalries begin again, which had been kept in abeyance by the danger threatening their race. Isn't that basically Satan divided against Satan and his kingdom can't stand?
Absolutely, but we don't know any better.
The idea underlying Bolshevism, the idea of unscrupulous disintegration and destruction of decency and culture for the diabolic purpose of destroying the nations, could have been born only in the Jewish brain. Just as Bolshevik practice, which with all its horrifying cruelty, is only possible when manipulated by the Jews. In accordance with their nature, these Jews do not show their faces in the open. They work underground, and in Western Europe they try to deny that they have anything to do with Bolshevism. That is the way they have always behaved and will behave in the future.
And that's the paradigm that's the paradigm they try to present, is that they're a capitalist Jews, and they're a religious Jews, and they're a Marxist Jews. And it's a lie.
They're
all capitalists and they're all Marxists. Because the object of Marxism is that the Jew ends up with all the capital. That's just crazy that we don't understand that. They're all the same. They're all Talmudists. They're all Satan. That's what they are. All right, go on. That's the end of the sermon.
They're basically different branches of the same tree.
Absolutely. The end result is always going to be the Jew ending up with all of the wealth of the world, because that's the goal of Satan, to end up with all the wealth of the world and to destroy all the white men. That's Satan's goal. And that, you know, that's expressed in many ways, and it's the religion of the Jews, and every one of their political expressions works towards that goal.
Some people think that all the Jews have to be capitalists or all the Jews have to be communists. Well, you know, the enemy doesn't always throw a jab. Sometimes it's a cross, sometimes it's an uppercut. There's different ways we experience their attacks. They have many fronts. But it's all Talmudism. But we have found them out, and what is more, we are the only people in the world who have the courage to call the attention of mankind to these capital criminals. We are not afraid of any consequences and call them by their right name. There was a time in Germany when anyone who called a Jew was sent to prison, but in spite of that, we dared to do it. Even today, the world very often objects with noble restraint or even with well-staged moral disapproval when Jews are called Jews or Bolshevists are called capital criminals. But we are convinced that we shall eventually succeed in opening the eyes of the world so as to make them see the true face of Jewry and Bolshevism, just as well as we succeeded in convincing Germany of the perilous, parasitic character of that race. In the meantime, we shall not tire of pointing to this fatal danger and appealing to the attention of all the people who are undergoing terrible crises and upheavals, proclaiming the Jews are to blame, the Jews are to blame. This charge will be like a lash in the face of the Jews, distorted as they are by hate. It won't help them either if they try to adopt the camouflage of democratic forms. That method is just a bit too ingenuous to impress intelligent people. It is only a ruse to catch the intellectual Philistines. They welcome this slogan because it enables them to fight shy of a decision. This so-called Bolshevist democracy, which some French and English papers have suggested as the prototype and counterpart of the so-called National Socialist dictatorship, is engulfed in terror, blood, and murder. Every few years, the Bolshevist despots proclaim this moth-eaten slogan whenever they feel the necessity of recommending themselves to Europe after a period of brutal terrorism. Then suddenly, canards are let loose by the communist propaganda bureaus, empty promises that a new constitution will be introduced, that the universal ballot, etc., will be granted to Russia. But all these promises are falsehoods. speculating upon the short memories and proverbial mental inertness of narrow-minded Philistines. And that always happens in this country. They promise us change. People forget a year earlier we were promised change, and here we are a year later, no change.
That's the way it is. Oh, we have change. We still have some change left, maybe.
In reality, Bolshevism is the crassest rule of blood and terror that the world has ever experienced. The Jews have planned it in order to make it impossible for power to be taken out of their hands, and it is Jews who are exercising it. We National Socialists, to justify and consolidate our national power honorably, have appealed to the country again and again, almost year after year, through general elections in which the laws of the secret ballot are observed. Bolshevism talks of people in the country of workers and peasants, but on its face is imprinted the word force. Each person forms for himself a certain idea of Bolshevism. For the most part, this idea is the product of his own brain. Then propaganda comes to his aid. Its means of working forms a picture of Bolshevism according to the mentality of a person or a group of persons or of a nation. It is all artificially managed. There is no real basis of truth in it. It may easily happen that representatives of a great country become enthusiastic about a new subway in Moscow, which would attract no attention whatsoever in another large city. When the Bolsheviks welcome the stranger with the strains of his own national anthem, these strangers, without any rational reason whatsoever, discard their former ideas about Bolshevism and make friends with it. The Red Jews in Moscow know how to handle their dupes. It is permissible to imagine how they mock and ridicule the attitude of the bourgeois world that it thus created. Therefore, they are very furious with us because we have recognized them and are bent on shattering to its very foundation the pictures of Bolshevism that is widely prevalent in Europe. Their hate against us is illimitable. It is one of the best and most honorable tributes to the character of our political struggle. We tear the mask from their faces and show them to the world in their true appearance. It has already been stated that the concept which various people and nations form of Bolshevism is a special outcome of Bolshevik propaganda. A great part of the art of deception consists, for instance, in making people believe that the Moscow government has nothing at all to do with the Comintern. That is about the most barefaced and brazen swindle that can be imagined, because there is only a division of administration between the Soviet government and the Comintern. But to think that one is independent of the other would be like believing that the National Socialist Movement has nothing to do with the National Socialist Government. Bolshevistic propaganda operates on a broad scale. Its purpose is to bring the world to destruction. In foreign countries, it is mistakenly interpreted. These naive people who accept it are generally the most naive of the naive. But they exist, and they have a certain effect of their own. Bolshevism in practice is something different. Excuse me, there it is, and you cannot deny what it does. In blood, it has traced its fearful march. Its intention is to bring the whole world into chaotic mess. It signifies the great attempt of Judaism to bring the nations under their own power. Therefore, the fight against this danger is, in the truest sense of the word, a world fight. And that's exactly what the Dutch ambassador said, that the entire world had a stake in ending Bolshevism right then and there in 1918.
Yes,
the world did nothing.
And Goebbels definitely understands that this is Judaism subjecting the world.
It was begun in Germany and has been fought out on German soil. Adolf Hitler is the historic leader in this campaign. We are all his representatives, and therewith we are the apostles of a great historical mission. There can never be a compromise between the two extremes. Bolshevism must be exterminated if Europe is to regain its normal state of health.
Now let me say a couple of things. Because in spite of what the biblical prophets say, that we know now in hindsight that this was meant to fail, right? It's just man can separate the wheat and the tares. Yahshua Christ told us that he would separate the wheat and the tares. And Adolf Hitler tried to separate the wheat and the tares before time. And it just failed. However, it should be extremely clear from this that Adolf Hitler and his regime, they were good Christian men making a stand against the Jewish domination of the Christian world. And we, like whores for the Jews, went and killed our brethren in Germany. And anybody that says that Adolf Hitler was a patsy for the Jews Adolf Hitler was a Jew. They're only covering for the crimes of the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Is basically the end result of what they're doing. This was a Christian nation making a stand for its own self-determination, and the West destroyed it at the behest of the Jews. And if you blame Hitler, if you blame the Nazis, if you blame Germany, then you are a whore for the Jew. That's all you are.
The world lined up against Germany just as the world lined up against South Africa at the order of the Jews.
And if you try to cover for the Jew crimes now, you may as well just go join a synagogue and wear a yarmulke, because that's where you belong.
All right. Would you like to take over the reading?
I believe you're at Bolshevism in practice is something different. There it is. You cannot deny what it does. In blood it has traced its fearful march. Its intention is to bring the whole world into its chaotic mess. It signifies the great attempt of Judaism to bring the nations under their own power. Well, I'll read this paragraph a second time, all right? Therefore, the fight against this danger is, in the truest sense of the word, a world fight. It was begun in Germany and has been fought out on German soil. Adolf Hitler is the historic leader in this campaign. He was the only one. He was the only one in Western Europe who made a stand against the Jewish takeover of Europe. We are all his representatives, and therewith we are the apostles of a great historical mission. There can never be a compromise between the two extremes. Bolshevism must be exterminated if Europe is to regain its normal state of health. But the Jews know exactly what is about to happen. In one of their last efforts, they have striven to mobilize all the forces of the world against Germany. They want to strengthen their power by a feverish rush of armament. In National Socialist Germany, they see a constant danger to their own existence. In Russia, Judaism has established a home for itself which they never thought would be endangered. And let me say that the whole thing in Palestine is just a sham. Up to 98%, it represents the new bourgeois class among the Soviets. Knaves, fatlings, dissemblers, intriguers and plotters, backslappers and frivolous people. These Jews who have now attained high positions are able to exercise their petty swindles over a large-scale area on 160 million people. They are ruthless tyrants, absolutely without principle. They inflict themselves on people like a universal scourge, the purpose of which is to spread catastrophe. I have already laid stress on the fact that Bolshevist propaganda is sufficiently astute to adjust its teaching to its hearers. It can be radical or moderate to suit the occasion. And look at all these American hippie kids just marching right along with the drumbeat, right? When the terrorist Dimitrov speaks before the Comintern, the attitude is different from that which Litvinov adopts before the League of Nations. The Bolshevist propaganda may be religious or anti-religious to suit the circumstances. It is utterly without conscience, and all means are justified by the ends they serve. All over the world, this propaganda has at its disposal a complex machinery which is made up of the communist sections in the various countries. And I would add to that that it was financed by the Jewish bankers. It only needs to press a button in order to put this machinery into operation. In every country it operates, either secretly or in the open. Woe to the nation that allows it to function. One day that nation will be undermined by this seditious activity and will be disrupted merely because this phenomenon has not been seriously taken into account.
And that happened in the United States.
That's the whole idea behind the Frankfurt School and all the programs that we did with the 50s and 60s radicals, and people didn't address that, nip that in the bud, and this is society today is what we end up with, where the girls are boys and the boys are girls, and sometimes you don't really know what they are. We National Socialists are in a happy position that we have no need to mince our words when we speak of Bolshevism. We do not speak the language of the secret cabinets. We speak the language of the people, and therefore hope that the people of outside nations will understand us. We are lucky enough to be able to call things by their names. And look at that line. We are lucky enough to be able to call things by their names. In other words, a sexual deviant is a sexual deviant, a nigger's a nigger, and that's the way it should be. And we feel bound to do so, for the world must have its eyes open. We cannot and we must not be silent in face of the danger that menaces Europe. It is incumbent on the nations and their governments to make their own decisions. But it is the right and the duty of every individual whom nature has endowed with the gift of insight and the power of self-expression to proclaim his opinions and convictions, to point the finger to forthcoming catastrophes, and to voice the needs of the time. To dally with Bolshevism spells ultimate ruin. And here we are. Therefore, we take the opportunity of this party Congress to ring the alarm against this world danger. I have taken this opportunity of pointing out what Bolshevism is in actual practice to unmask its teaching, and therewith we are helping towards the understanding of the history of our own times, which has to be learned and must not be forgotten. And now we come to the point the Western European worker is apt to consider the Soviet as a proletarian state, i.e. as his state. He thinks that in Russia the working class succeeded in eliminating the capitalistic exploiters and in establishing the dictatorship of the proletariat, where the free workers are now building up a state of their own, the fatherland of the working people. And that's all I ever heard when I was a kid. That was the propaganda. But the Jews, like Dave Ricardo or Marx Mardoshay, have been the originators of the Marxist teaching. And Jews like LaSalle, Wolfson, Adler, Liebknecht, Luxembourg, Levi, etc., have organized all labor movements. From their safe editorial chairs, Jews have urged the workers to the barricades. Jews like Paul Singer, Schiff, Kahn, etc., were the financiers of Marxist Bolshevism. The Soviet government has been and still is almost completely composed of Jews. Not one worker belongs to the governing body. Almost all of the Bolshevist leaders who have been recently shot in Moscow were Jews. That's the purges of Stalin. There was not one worker among them. The triumvirate, which rose as the victorious group out of this inter-Jewish conflict and which now holds dictatorship over the Soviet Union, is composed of Herschel Yehuda, or Jagoda, head of the OGPU, Lazarus, Moses' son, Kaganovich, father-in-law of Stalin and commissary for the transport Finkelstein-Litwinoff, commissary for foreign affairs, all of whom are Jews who came from the ghetto. The government of the Soviet Union is not the dictatorship of the proletariat, but the dictatorship of Jewry over the rest of the population. The political agitation of Bolshevism is equaled by its demagogical propaganda in the economic sphere. They proclaim that the worker leads a sort of paradisiacal life in the Soviet Union, a life of paradise in the Soviet Union. As late as April 1932, the newspaper Rotfan demanded in its electoral campaign, put a stop to the increase of wages. Wages have to be decreased. We demand the 7-hour working day, the 40-hour week, and adjusted wages. But how is the situation in Soviet Russia? The price of bread rose from 9 to 75 kopecks per kilogram within the years between 1928 and 1935. The monthly wage of a Soviet worker has fallen 78.5%, measured by the quantity of bread which the worker can buy. If the Russian worker wants to earn enough to live, he has to work according to the Stakhanov system, which has raised the norm so much above the average that the mass of workers can never reach it. The result is that the average Russian worker gets much lower wages. In 1932, the Rotfond published a report on the housing conditions, which had been sent in by a comrade working in the Soviet Union. He wrote that he had two large rooms for himself with electricity and central heating. And now a true picture of reality. A working woman writes in Leningradskaya Pravda, a communist paper, we, that is, I myself and my little boy, who is a year and a half old, my brother and my sister, who suffers from tuberculosis, live in one small and dark room. Our complaints brought before the Communist Municipal Commission have been fruitless. We are still living as before in these unbelievable conditions. The Russian worker has to spend for a simple food which consists only of bread, cabbage soup, and gruel, not less than 75% of his total income. He would have to spend twice the amount of the average wage to attain the standard of living which the German worker has. A well-known Bolshevist slogan promises the establishment of the free right to work. On June 20, 1932, the Rotfond wrote, "Look towards Moscow, Leningrad, Baku, Novosibirsk, and know, work, bread, and liberty can only be attained if we fight and follow the example of the Bolsheviki." Tell me that's not some propaganda. In the way in which the Soviet workers are urged to work by the Stakhanov system may rightly be called slavery. Now, isn't that the goal of the Talmud, is to enslave all of the non-Jews?
Well, doesn't it say that every Jew will be a king and every goyim will be a serf?
Absolutely. But the Soviet Union even reintroduced slavery in the verbal meaning of the word. About 6.5 million people who work in the forced labor camps of the Soviet Union are living in a state of hell on earth. In 300 giant forced labor camps, Bolshevism is squeezing the last ounce of working energy out of these workers. Some hundred thousands of people had to be buried when the Stalin-Caspian Channel was built by forced labor gangs. The following Jewish leaders of the OGPU forced the channel to be built in such murderous speed: Herschel, Jagoda, Davidson, Kwasnitsky, Isaacson, Rotenberg, Ginsburg, Brodsky, Berenson, Dorfman, Cogner, Angert, and others. Judaism flourishes the whip over the fatherland of the proletariat.
That can't be. Only German Nazis make people work in camps and cause millions to suffer.
Well, right. And everything that Goebbels has said about the deaths and the camps and the starvation, the Jews have blamed on the Nazis ever since World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Of doing it to them in Germany. But in reality, they did it to many times more Christians in Russia. And many times more sense.
And for that matter, they even killed their own. They will eat their own on a regular basis.
Well, wolves eat wolves. Wolves eat weak wolves all the time. Wolves eat sheep. I mean, I'm sure they like sheep a lot better, right? But they eat wolves.
Mm-hmm.
Bolshevist propaganda boasts of having freed the working class among the peasants from the claws of capitalistic exploitation. To allure the innocent peasants to get their confidence, Bolshevism founded the Peasants International. In its program, we find the following proclamation: "We demand that the burden of taxes be lifted from the middle class of the peasants, that their taxes be decreased. We demand the expropriation of the large estates, which shall be made available free of charge for the sons of the peasants who till the soil. Let us have a look at the situation as it exists in reality. The granaries of Soviet Russia, which formerly helped to supply Western Europe with the necessary cereals, are no longer in a position to feed their own population. Millions of people are starving. A bitter war is being waged between the terroristic apparatus of the OGPU and the peasants. The Jews, Kaganovich, Jagoda, and Bauman, and forced a radical collectivization of the peasants, which simply killed more than 15 million peasants and members of peasant families." That's aside for how many bourgeois were killed in the cities, probably many more. "The main achievement of the peasant policy carried out by the Bolshevists is the terroristic law of August 7, 1932, which, for any kind of wrong committed by a peasant, enacts the death penalty, 10 years of hard labor or forced labor sentences. Judeo-Bolshevism even abuses the relation of child to parent in applying this law. Izvestia reports on May 28, 1934, how a girl denounced her father, who had kept back grain that had been commissioned by the collective. Under the terror law, her father was subject to the death penalty. The child received official congratulation for her act." And our schools today have our children ratting out their parents for perceived wrongs.
Well, It seems that every kid knows if your parent disciplines you, all you have to do is say they touched you somewhere, or they hit you, or they did this, or they said that, and the county will take you away, put you in a foster home with a Jew who's really going to touch you, but meanwhile your parents are in prison.
Well, that's the that's a sign that we're under a Jewish domination, that we're under the rule of Satan. Well, whenever you see injustice committed by the government, know that Satan's in charge. A Christian government could never do such a thing.
Didn't Isaiah say that women would rule over his people and children would terrorize them? That children would be their oppressors, women would rule over them, and that the people would be led to great error?
There is no doubt. You want to pick up from here?
All right. In pre-National Socialist Germany, the Communist Party put forward the following demands in their program for the soldiers. Point 12, annulment of the order to live in barracks. Point 12, abolition of all undesirable persons in command. Point 20, annulment of the order to live in barracks. And I'd like to point out here that the Soviets tried this. They did away with saluting. They did away with rank distinction. They did away with officers. They did this in the early days of the revolution. And they made all orders voluntary. They would vote on them. But very soon after, they suffered appalling casualties and they had to reinstitute mandatory orders. So if you were ordered...
And that was actually covered by the Russia No. 1 report.
They made orders optional.
Right. It wasn't covered in detail, but we saw the results of it in the Russia No. 1 report. And they did actually discuss how they were going to reinstitute discipline into the army.
Well, when you're taking fire, it's no time to debate what you should do. If the sergeant says, duck and take cover, you don't pause and take a vote. But I assume, you know, leave it to Jews who have never been in combat to wreck the military like that, just like they've wrecked the military in this country.
Right. Well, don't ask, don't tell, right?
Emancipation from blind obedience and the democratization of the army were the slogans. Compulsory mobilization of the work people was introduced forthwith after the Bolshevik dictatorship had been set up. Those who did not obey the orders were shot or sent to the blood dungeons of the Cheka. Instead of the voluntary people's militia, there was a central authoritarian command. Iron proletarian discipline. The forced conscripts were interned in barracks, and the strictest laws, court martials, were set up. From the comrade commandants, the whole army aristocracy was chosen, including lieutenants, captains, etc., up to the red marshals. The Soviet Jew Rabinowitz cynically admitted that the simulated democratization of the army was, quote, only a ruse to gain control of the army, quote. Another Bolshevik slogan, which is widely believed, is the emancipation of women. The pretension is that the woman must be freed from the domestic yoke and placed on equal footing with the man. In the year 1924, the Comintern Congress explicitly stated, quote, the revolution is powerless as long as the family and family conditions remain, end quote. But in the practical administration of the Soviet Union, the actual way of this highly vaunted emancipation of woman shows itself in the fact that without having the right to appeal for protection, women are forced to submit and surrender themselves to the arbitrary demands of the men, and they have to earn their livelihood by heavy manual labor. Even in the labor camps, which have the worst reputation, there are more than 1 million women.
And it's funny how the Jews, they deny the protocols, but this is a major plank in the protocols. The destruction of the family and the removal of women from the authority of the family so that they could rape, so that they could have sex with them anytime they want, basically.
Well,
sexual liberation is totally satanic. It's totally Jewish.
We proved that in Russia No. 1, liberation of the women took the form of nationalization of women, and they forced women to submit to the sexual lusts of various Jews, and if they wouldn't, they were whipped.
Right, and if they wouldn't, some of them suffered a much worse fate than that.
Yes.
Yeah,
furthermore,
that's it. It's the emancipation of women is all about Satan seducing Eve over and over again.
Furthermore, Bolshevist propaganda asserts that the woman is released from the burden of having to look after her children. This task is taken over by the Soviet state itself. At the same time, the official party press is forced to acknowledge that the army of waifs and youthful criminals is steadily on the increase. A special and influential appeal in the system of Bolshevist propaganda is the demand for the abrogation of the legal veto against abortion. The practice of abortion, which went on without hindrance for 18 years, has become so prevalent that the Soviets would now like to forbid this practice of abortion. Bolshevist propaganda in regard to the position of women in the social order reaches the peak of mental aberration when it declares that in the bourgeois social order, prostitution is a necessary evil, but that this will finally disappear with the establishment of communism. There is no country in the world where the spectacle of prostitution is so universal as in the Soviet Union. Even in order to hold their jobs, working women have to submit to the desires of their bosses. In the truest sense of the term, women in this paradise of women are the open prey of the Jewish Soviet bullies.
That's the Jewish idea of heaven, isn't it? All the Aryan women he could get his hands on for free.
The study trip made by the French statistician Harriot during the famine period of 1933 offers a specially crass example of how bemused politicians of Western liberalism may be allured by Soviet propaganda. On this point, the Jewish New York paper Forward, which certainly cannot be suspected of pro-Nazi leanings, declared as follows. On the day preceding the arrival of the delegation, the whole population of Kiev was mobilized at 2 o'clock in the night to clean the main streets. 10,000 hands worked feverishly to give a European aspect to the neglected and filthy town. All relief centers, cooperative stores, were closed. Queues were forbidden. The imposing army of waves, beggars, and starvelings were all removed. Militiamen on highly groomed horses strutted at the street crossings, manes of their horses entwined with white ribbons, a picture which Kiev saw never before or after. One of the great parade pieces from the arsenal of Bolshevist propaganda is the claim for the abolition of the army, the demand for all-around and complete disarmament. The KPD, German Communist Party, under the slogan No More War, forward with the fight against armament, for instance, demanded a plebiscite on the following proposition. The construction of dreadnoughts and cruisers of all kinds is forbidden. And in February 1932, the Jew Finkelstein Litvinov took occasion at one of the innumerable Geneva conferences to champion before the world the principle of complete disarmament. It seems interesting that in the 50s and 60s and 70s, there was a huge nuclear disarmament movement in the U.S. saying that we should unilaterally disarm in the face of a superpower across the ocean that had just as many nukes as we did, but there was conspicuously no disarmament movement in the Soviet Union.
The peaceniks, the disarmament freaks, the anti-gun crowd, they're all the same Jews. They're all the same Jews that want to strip the Aryan Christian nations of any chance to defend themselves.
So why is it that only disarmament should occur in the West and only we should disarm?
Well, right. The disarmament must occur until the Jew gets control. Once the Jew gets control, there's anything but disarmament.
Absolutely. Up to the present, no change has taken place in these methods of deception. This statement is corroborated by the declaration which the same Litvinov made last July when he said that, quote, complete disarmament was a maximal guarantee of peace. That's Bolshevist propaganda. And what is the reality? The peace strength of the Red Army amounts to 2 million by reason of lowering of the age limit of those liable for military service. But to this, we add the trained reserves, which number from 9 to 10 million. In case of war, therefore, they can mobilize 11 million, and within a practical period of time, even 14 million. Should war break out, the Red Army would be able to issue marching orders to Red soldiers of between 160 and 180 infantry divisions and 25 cavalry divisions. Recently, the increase in tank forces was declared by the Red Marshal Chuikovsky as 2,475%. The strength of the Red Air Force amounts to 6,000 planes. The planes of the first line are divided into 31 heavy and light bombers and scout planes and 15 chassers. The bombing weapon prevails over all others and proves that the Red Air Force is preeminently a weapon of attack.
That's 3,100 heavy and light bombers and 1,500 chasers.
Yes. The idea is that in case of war, the bombing plane should be able to make a surprise attack before the attacked country will have time to organize its defense. The view of the Soviet strategists is that the next war will be begun without any introductory declaration of war, and it is not generally known that the Soviets possess the greatest submarine force in the world. The aggressive character of the Red Army is testified by the aggressive strategy of its leaders. One of the great paragons of efficiency in the Soviet regime is that of the obvious justice of the victorious Bolshevik regime on a world extension, according to Chuikovsky, who said, Bolshevism will strive with elementary force to embrace the whole world by direct influence. Its most important means will be its military power. That's just one way of saying we will dominate the world by force.
Right, and it's exactly what they plan to do. But most of that military buildup was financed by the West.
Exactly. And didn't they accuse Hitler of claiming we will take over the world? But show me a speech where Hitler said, they always say, today we rule Germany, tomorrow the world. Show me where.
It'll never be found.
And now the most incredible thing of all, in spite of this very obvious imperialistic kind of argument, Bolshevik propaganda insists even today that Moscow adheres to a policy of peace. Quote, the Soviet Union does not wish to expand its territory. It is always there when peace is to be defended and maintained. End quote. That is the kind of lie that Mr. Litvinov casts into the face of the world. And the French communist leader Thorez declares in Humanité, quote, we have shown that the aim of peace is inseparable from the policy of the Soviet Union, end quote. I wonder what they were saying as the Soviet Union was invading Finland.
That's those bold-faced lies that was spoken about earlier.
A great Soviet state is coming into Finland to liberate the workers from the Finnish capitalist regime.
Peace, peace when there is no peace, right?
Exactly. In glaring contrast to this systematic campaign of falsehoods, we have the political offensive of the military pacts. Under the slogan of collective security, these were established between Moscow and Paris on May 2, 1935, and between Moscow and Prague on May 16, 1935. A little while ago, the mayor of St. Denis, Jacques Derat, formerly a communist and now leader of the Parti Populaire Français, describes the purpose of the Franco-Bolshevik military pact in the following words. And when they have formulated it in true earnest, when Kachin is president of the Republic and Thorez is prime minister and Paré is foreign minister, under orders from Moscow, they will unleash the dogs of war against Germany and thus secure freedom for the Soviet Union on their Western Front. End quote. And the case is not otherwise with the military pact between Moscow and Prague. On December 15, 1935, a Soviet airman and member of the Communist Party made the following declaration on that point to a representative of the French paper Grenouillère. Quote, the erection of air stations in the neighborhood of Prague and in the hinterland would be an ideal move for us. From these points, only half the aeroplanes are necessary and only half the fuel is needed. Hence, it would be possible for us to carry an extra 3 tons of explosives. End quote. Meanwhile, great numbers of these red air stations have been erected in Czechoslovakian territory. Recently, they were increased to 36. Slovenské Deník, which is a newspaper published at Pressburg and controlled by the prime minister, made the astonishing admission, quote, if the air stations are intended for the defense of the state, then assuredly no geese will be found grazing on them. They will be a refuge for those friends of ours who may find them adapted for use and protection. In other words, those 36 air stations are meant to be the starting points from which the red bombers will attack Europe. This is an acute danger. That is proved by the fact that the red bombers could thus reach the most important strategic points in Western Europe within less than an hour and could destroy these. So it seems the myth that Germany attacked peaceful Czechoslovakia that wasn't doing anything to provoke it has been debunked.
Well, that's a total lie. It's all a total lie. There was a huge Soviet buildup of arms on the frontier, on the West.
They were encircling Germany, much like the U.S. and the Jewish regime is encircling Iran and Russia today.
If it weren't for Germany, we would have had an Irish Soviet Socialist Republic. An Icelandic Soviet Socialist Republic.
Portuguese Soviet Socialist Republic.
Absolutely. And they wouldn't have stopped there.
Germany
threw herself on the pyre.
They would have crossed the Atlantic and they would have crossed the Mediterranean and gone all the way to South Africa.
And look at how we repaid Germany. It's Jews on one side running the Bolshevik state, running the Soviet state. And then everything that Americans thought they knew in the 1930s and 40s was supplied by who?
Jews.
Reuters, the New York Times, the Washington Post, all Jews. The entire media at that time, CBS. Bill Polinsky, William Polinsky, the Jew that founded CBS.
Right. From the air bases of the Red Army within Czechoslovakian territory, Dresden, for example, could be reached within 20 minutes, Chemnitz within 11 minutes, the Silesian Industrial District within 9 minutes, Berlin within 42 minutes, Vienna within 9 minutes, the munition works in Steyr within 17 minutes, in the manufacturing district of the Steiermark within 27 minutes. The Red Plains could reach Budapest within about 6 minutes and make it a heap of dust and ashes. And that's ultimately what they did.
Absolutely.
That is the story of the Bolshevist peace policy. On this spot last year, I gave an exact account of how many clergymen had been murdered in Russia and pointed to the danger of such a procedure being repeated in other countries. But even ecclesiastical circles in outside countries poo-pooed this warning. They expressed the naive view that Bolshevism had changed and that in future it would guarantee freedom of worship to religious denominations. Meanwhile, events in Spain have shown only too clearly that I was right. In all districts in which the Madrid government rule, there is no longer a church that is open, so writes the Diario de la Marina. And the Catholic Church has even officially announced that in Barcelona alone, 250 priests have been murdered and several churches demolished. That is the kind of religious freedom which one enjoys under Bolshevist rule.
And clowns like Ernest Hemingway were romanticized by the entire American press for going and fighting on the side of the communists.
They should have been thrown in prison.
Well, they should have been shot. He should have been shot the moment he tried to come back into the country. All of them. And he was just one of the most notable ones.
Well, you know, I read of several German-Americans that went back to Germany in 39, before Germany was at war with America, when war broke out with the West, or in 41 when Germany invaded the Soviet Union to preempt them, before America was at war with Germany. They joined the German military, the Waffen-SS, the Luftwaffe, what have you, and after the war they were tracked down and killed. Those that survived.
And guys like Hemingway are heroes, right?
He's just a tin-pot communist crud.
Right, exactly. And it shows you how hypocritical our own government is. And
right.
Long before we were born. I think this is probably a good place to leave this off.
Stop, because we're halfway through the document. And
we're over halfway through the document.
We'll have some Mein Kampf stuff next week, won't we?
Yes, absolutely. Because it's important to stress. Yeah, you know, we went through the entire Russia Number One report portraying the horrors of Bolshevism, and that Adolf Hitler feared, and the German people feared. And Adolf Hitler was successful in coming to the leadership of the Reich because he was the only German politician who actually stood against the Bolshevik horror. None of the others had any balls. That they were all kissing Talmudic behind. They were all sucking up to the Jews. That they were all vacillating or compromising. And Adolf Hitler's the only one that stood up.
Or they were Talmudists themselves.
Well, right. But Hitler's the only one that stood up. And that's why he got 90% of the vote, 95% of the vote, 98% of the vote, because he's the only one that stood up. And the German people knew what happened in the East.
And the American people never had a clue. That's why they continually elected Rosenfeld.
All of this propaganda that we see today, Hitler was a Rothschild agent, Hitler was part Jewish, Hitler was this, Hitler was that. It's all brought to us, it's all produced by the Jews because they do not want our people to actually examine what really went on in Europe in the 30s and 40s. The Jews fear that.
Well, right now, since they control history, they control the future.
As long as we let them control history.
Mm-hmm. That's why they can't stand for us to examine history.
And all these little trolls and all these little forums telling us that Hitler was a Jew, they're all Zionist butt wipes. And clowns like Jim Condit, who produces all this garbage about Hitler being a Rothschild agent. If Hitler was a Rothschild agent, Germany would have had a central bank. It would have fallen into socialist hands with the rest of Europe. And it would have been over. The 60s would have happened in the 40s.
And there wouldn't have been a Second World War.
There would have been no Second World War. We would have had one giant love fest where we'd all be half-breeds today. The 60s would have happened in the 40s. There's no doubt.
And we'd all probably look like Barack Obama.
Please. That's exactly the truth. And all these Hitler conspiracy theorists, that they're all just doormats for the Jews. That's it, to try to put it nicely. Okay, we'll finish this next week.
All right. Yahweh bless.
Praise Yahweh.